The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated October 19th, 2012. And as always, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first item here is entitled, Unemployment Drops Below 8%. Here's what happened. The U.S. economic recovery is showing signs of picking up speed after the jobless rate fell unexpectedly in September, and this summer's hiring numbers were revised upward. September's unemployment rate of 7.8% was the lowest level since President Obama took office, giving his faltering re-election campaign a boost. The rate fell from 8.1% in August as an estimated 114,000 people found jobs. The Labor Department also said that 86,000 more jobs had been created in July and August than previously estimated. Obama welcomed the dip in unemployment. It is a reminder the country has come too far to turn back now, he said. The surprise drop in unemployment led some Republicans to question September's jobs report, which former General Electric Chief Executive Jack Welch accusing the government of massaging the numbers to benefit Obama as the election nears. These Chicago guys will do anything, tweeted Welch. Can't debate, so change numbers. The Bureau of Labor Statistics said its data was collected by hundreds of career employees who'd held their jobs through several administrations and scoffed at the idea of partisan manipulation. Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney said the job creation rate was still too low. This is not what a real recovery looks like, he said. Now here's what the editorial said. Obama has reason to crow, said the Washington Post. The jobless rate has fallen from a high of 10% in October of 2009 to below 8%. This is not small progress, especially given the epochal financial crisis we experienced in 2008. Obama's financial sector rescue, his bailout of GM and Chrysler, and yes, his $814 billion stimulus package helped blunt the impact of the meltdown and get people back to work. Happy days are not here again, said the Wall Street Journal. 3 years into the weakest of economic recoveries, more than 12 million Americans are officially still out of work. 40% of them for 6 months or more, and the economy is over 4.5 million jobs short of where it was in 2007. Bottom line, the job market still stinks. The bigger, knottier picture here, said the Philadelphia Daily News, is that our economy has major structural problems. Most of the new jobs are low-wage in retail or hospitality, while startups, the real engine of job growth, aren't emerging quickly enough or hiring enough workers. In today's highly technological and cloud-based world, we need bold, innovative thinking for a 21st century economy. Unfortunately, our presidential candidates' stale ideas, more training, tax cuts, and trade agreements don't match up with our new problems. Now here's what the columnist said. Clearly we've hit that point in the election when people begin to lose their minds, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. The idea that the White House could somehow manipulate the jobs numbers is laughable. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is set up to ensure the White House has no ability to influence it, with a nonpartisan staff of government bureaucrats and no political appointees. Even if it could be done, said Deborah Solomon in Bloomberg.com, would Obama have waited until now, 5 weeks before the election, to monkey with the numbers? The numbers may not be fudged, said James Shirk in National Review. view.com, but they are very misleading. A drop from 8.3% unemployment in July to 7.8% today would require stronger job creation than any time since the height of the Reagan economic boom. Other economic indicators, such as new claims for unemployment insurance, point to continued slow growth. Look, these short-term job statistics are unreliable estimates anyway, said Joe Nocera in the New York Times. So it's truly absurd for the presidential race to hinge on the unemployment rate, especially since no president has much control over the economy. Even so, there's some rough justice to how this is playing out politically. Republicans have blamed Obama for the high unemployment rate for months on end, but can only stand by helplessly as it dips below 8%. The economy is slowly getting better. Awful, isn't it? And we'll continue the main story section now with our next article, The Taliban's Cowardly Attack. Pakistani Taliban gunmen attacked and seriously wounded a 14-year-old activist for girls' education this past week, unleashing a wave of international outrage and calls for renewed offensives against the country's militant strongholds. Malala Yousafzai, who became known around the world in 2009 when she wrote a diary for the BBC about life under the Taliban occupation, was riding home from school when militants stopped the bus, asked for her by name, and shot her in the head and neck. The Pakistani Taliban's claimed responsibility for the shooting, calling Yousafzai's crusade for education an obscenity. She has become a symbol of Western culture, a Taliban spokesman said, adding that if she survived, militants would try to kill her again. Let this be a lesson. Malala Yousafzai is in critical condition today, and so is Pakistan, said the News in Pakistan in an editorial. We are infected with the cancer of extremism, and unless it is cut out, we will slide even further into the bestiality that this latest atrocity exemplifies. For the sake of this brave girl, we must all stand up to the ruthless murderers who would see every girl's school blown up. It's no wonder that Yousafzai topped the Taliban's target list, said Will Dobson in Slate.com. For them, a free-thinking schoolgirl is far more terrifying than some Western NGO activist who just parachuted into Pashtun country. She's a grown, homegrown symbol of progress, education, and enlightenment, courageously challenging militants' backward beliefs, even in the face of intimidation. If people like Yousafzai were to multiply, the Taliban would have no future. This attack shows how desperate the Islamist militants truly are, said Jay Bookman in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Social change and modernity will come one day to these territories, but it will take decades rather than months or years. The West must be patient as it continues to promote women's rights and other human values. But knowing that courageous souls like Yousafzai remain vulnerable in the meantime does not make the wait any easier. The next item from the main story section, Romney on foreign policy. Mitt Romney sought to burnish his foreign policy credentials this past week, arguing in a speech at the Virginia Military Institute that President Obama's failure to show forceful leadership has made the world a more dangerous place. Declaring that hope is not a strategy, the Republican presidential nominee announced that he would increase military spending, implement tougher sanctions on Iran, and work to ease tensions between the U.S. and Israel. It is time to change course, he said. We cannot support our friends and defeat our enemies in the Middle East when our words are not backed up by deeds. Romney lamented that the president has failed to lead in Syria and pledged to work with members of the opposition who share our values and ensure they obtain the arms they need to defeat President Bashar al-Assad. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, an Obama supporter, dismissed the speech as full of platitudes and free of substance. Romney made a stirring case for a more assertive foreign policy, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The fires now burning across the Middle East, from the recent attack on our consulate in Libya to the 20-month-old civil war in Syria, rage in a vacuum created by the perception that the U.S. is withdrawing from the region. Obama's weakness has emboldened our enemies. It's time for the world's only superpower to reassert its leadership. Here we go again, says the Boston Globe. Romney shares with George Bush a messianic belief in America's ability to shoulder the world's burdens alone. That deluded worldview resulted in two unfunded wars that raised the national debt by $800 billion. Now Romney wants to bring back Bush's failed policies, but today we are even less able to afford them. Actually, Romney's foreign policy is almost indistinguishable from Obama's, said Michael McGough in the Los Angeles Times. Look beyond his forceful language and you'll see that Romney all but echoed the president's warnings on Iran's nuclear program and the importance of a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem. His aim was to sound tougher than Obama while also adopting the president's widely approved foreign policy. Speak roughly, in other words, and carry a same-sized stick. Now we'll turn to the controversy of the week. The debate, has Obama lost the will to win? Does Barack Obama even want to win the election, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. Judging by the president's listless performance in Denver on the first debate, the answer appears to be no, and he may get his wish. After Republican Mitt Romney trounced Obama in their first presidential debate, Obama's once commanding poll lead disappeared, with RealClearPolitics.com's poll of polls showing Romney ahead this week, 48% to 47%. The Obama who debated Romney looked grouchy and depressed. Nearly 4 years ago, he floated into the White House, genuinely believing that he could be a postpartisan figure who would conquer this presidency as he had everything else. Instead, his term has been marked by constant conflict and frustration, and 40 million or so Americans hate him. Obama certainly thinks he deserves to be president, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, but he has come to disdain everything connected with politics, including debating. In the final days of the 2008 campaign, Obama joked to an aide that, given the collapsing economy, maybe I should throw the game. Last week in Denver, he may have done just that. And, of course, as you know, the second debate has been held. It was quite a different picture, and we will have more details about the second presidential debate, I am sure, in next week's reading of the Week magazine. Meanwhile, here's what some of the editorials had to say about all this. Liberals may be reeling, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. But to the rest of us, Obama's dismal performance was no surprise. Despite the media's best efforts to portray him as a gifted orator on the level of Churchill or Cicero, the real Obama is the single most overrated politician of my lifetime, a pedantic, monotonous lecturer with no talent for persuasion. The guy whom Romney demolished in Denver is the same man who never managed to make Obamacare popular after more than 50 speeches and pronouncements. Obama's strange incapacity to respond forcefully and cogently to Romney's attacks on his economic record was nothing new, said Obama biographer David Remnick in NewYorker.com. The president has myriad skills as a thinker and as a speaker, but he's fundamentally an introverted loner who suffers from an episodic unwillingness to connect with people. That flaw has hampered his first term and may cost him a second. You'll see a different Obama in the next two debates, said John Heilemann in NYMag.com. It may have looked as if Obama had lost his mojo, but his advisors specifically instructed him to avoid attacking Romney directly for fear he'd look mean. Their theory was that Obama was best served by playing it safe, and that confronting Romney might undermine the likability they perceive as Obama's greatest strength. Clearly, that strategy backfired, but from here on, the ultra-competitive Obama will surely raise his game. It may be too late for that, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com. Obama's performance was so passive and apologetic, so utterly devoid of passionate, positive vision for the next 4 years, that it was close to disqualifying. Instead of going on offense on Romney's videotaped dismissal of 47% of Americans, Obama let Romney get away with redefining himself as a moderate and best friend of the middle class. Obama's problem goes deeper than poor debating skills, said Yuval Levin in NationalReview.com. His entire campaign strategy was to paint a caricature of Mitt Romney as a scary ideologue, a bumbling, heartless plutocrat. With a forceful and reasonable Romney on display, Democrats are in trouble. So now what? Try to revive the caricature? Talk about the Obama record? Not exactly a wealth of great options. Now we'll move away from political stuff, at least for a few minutes here. It's hard to do during this time of year, of course, and we will turn to the popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for the nuns. Now, that's spelled N-O-N-E-S, not like the Catholic sisters. The nuns, after a Pew survey, found that 1 in 5 Americans is not affiliated with any religion. Nuns are growing faster than any religious group in America. It was a good week for putting that degree to use after Jamie Foxx, a 22-year-old from Great Britain with a degree in music, was given a job as a human scarecrow on a farm. Foxx will make $400 a week scaring off partridges by playing an accordion, ukulele, and a cowbell. And it was a good week for partisan consolation after JetBlue said it would offer a chance to win free round-trip tickets to other countries for disgusted customers who preferred presidential candidate losing the election. The company is planning to give away more than 1,000 tickets. It was a bad week for Florida Governor Rick Scott, who thought he was announcing the phone number of a meningitis hotline, but provided the number of a phone sex line. Callers have heard a woman say, "Hello, boys." It was a bad week for coping with rejection after Gerald and Lily Chow of Hong Kong sued Mark Zimney, a college admissions consultant and former Harvard professor, when their two sons didn't get into an Ivy League university. The Chows say they gave Zimney more than $2 million to get their kids into elite schools by any means necessary. And it was a bad week for disappointing the mystery monkey after the wild rhesus mock who stalked Tampa Bay for 3 years bit and scratched an elderly woman. "He gets up in my tree and starts shaking it because he wants to be fed," said Jeff Seilbach, a neighbor of the attacked woman. "If you don't feed him, he cops an attitude." Now in our Reading of the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the briefing section, and this week the briefing title is The History of Presidential Debates. Mitt Romney and Barack Obama's clash last week was just the latest in a long tradition of presidential showdowns. When were the first debates held? The seven encounters between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas in 1858 are widely considered to be the first presidential debates, even though they took place 2 years before the men were actually running for president. The modern tradition of televised presidential head-to-heads began in 1960 when John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon debated live on air before an audience of 74 million viewers. Since then, presidential debates have become a quadrennial staple of the political calendar and are consistently the most watched campaign events. The ability to perform well in the debates has become a key qualification for the nomination, said political analyst Larry Sabato. When parties are considering their candidates, they ask who would look better on TV, who comes across better, who can debate better. He said this has been taken into the calculus. How did the Nixon-Kennedy debate come out? Locked in a dead heat, each of the candidates believed he would benefit from the increased exposure of a televised face-off. Nixon was sure he'd excel, having successfully debated Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev on TV in Moscow the year before. He was badly mistaken. The TV cameras loved Kennedy's good looks and dynamic manner, but were cruel to Nixon, revealing his heavy 5 o'clock shadow, sweaty upper lip, and pasty pallor. It didn't help that the Republican, who was recovering from an illness at the time, wore powder makeup that melted under the studio lights. Upon seeing Nixon on television, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley reportedly said, "My God, they've embalmed him right before he even died." Radio listeners declared Nixon the winner, but the television images damned him. The mushrooming TV audience saw Nixon as a truthless used car salesman, wrote Hunter Thompson, and they voted accordingly. Kennedy won the election by just 119,000 votes out of 69 million cast. It would be 16 years before another televised presidential debate was held. Why the long gap? Well, many assume that Nixon's disastrous experience made presidential candidates wary of squaring off on TV, but the truth is more complicated. To clear the way for the 1960 debate, television executives had persuaded Congress to suspend the Federal Communications Commission's rule on equal broadcasting time for all candidates, so Kennedy and Nixon could debate without the presence of fringe candidates, like Rutherford L. Decker of the Prohibition Party. But Congress refused to grant that exemption again. Broadcasters got around the FCC rule in 1976 by treating the debate as a sponsored news event rather than a public service. The League of Women Voters agreed to act as sponsor that year and would do so again in 1980 and 1984, after Gerald Ford challenged Jimmy Carter to a series of debates. The Republican president, 30 points behind in the race, felt it might help him catch up, but he may well have regretted that impulse later on. Why is that? The first 1976 debate was hampered by technical difficulties that left both candidates stuck on stage, mute, for 27 minutes, while the feed was repaired. But Ford's truly disastrous moment came in the second debate, when in answer to a question he said, "There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe," at a time when between 10 and 15 Soviet divisions were based in Poland alone. "This was a very serious mistake that he made," said Carter in 1989, "and I don't know if the election didn't turn on it." Did Ford's remark really matter? The media had a field day with it, but a gaffe by his running mate Bob Dole in the vice presidential debate a few weeks later may have had even more impact. Dole characterized World War I, World War II, and the wars in Korea and Vietnam as democratic wars. "In the wake of that overstep, I had to try to keep a straight face," recalled his opponent, Walter Mondale. "I think they blew the election right there. But each debate season produces a line that is remembered as a gaffe, whether it's President Carter's admission in 1980 that he let his 13-year-old daughter guide his feelings on nuclear disarmament, or Michael Dukakis's emotionless response in 1988 when asked whether he would support the death penalty for the perpetrator if his wife were raped and murdered. "No, I don't," he said. Such mistakes are often credited as turning points in the race, though rarely by the people that made them. "I have to tell you, and maybe I'm still missing this," Dukakis said many years later, "I didn't think it was that bad." Do debates decide elections? Only rarely. A Gallup study from 2008 found that a good debate performance generally gives a candidate a temporary bump, but no more. The exceptions Gallup found were in 1960 and 2000, when Al Gore's repeated sighs of exasperation caused him to lose ground to George W. Bush. But even if the debate's impact on the race is negligible, many feel they have an insidious impact on politics in general. If we test presidential candidates by their talents on TV quiz performances, historian Daniel Boorstin predicted in 1962, we will of course choose presidents for precisely these qualifications. And the footnote from this briefing article here about presidential debates is entitled Making the Rules. The League of Women Voters was charged with setting the format for the three presidential debates from 1976 to 1984, but often found itself buffeted by candidates' demands. In 1980, Jimmy Carter refused to attend a debate alongside third-party challenger John Anderson, effectively squeezing him out so he could debate Ronald Reagan one-on-one. In 1987, the two parties established the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates, which has set the ground rules ever since. The CPD has resisted the whims of candidates to change the form, venue, and time of debates. But it has been criticized for shutting out smaller political parties and for softening the debate format to favor speechifying over actual confrontation. No cross questions or cross answers, no rebuttals, no follow-up questions, said civil rights lawyer Connie Rice. That's not a debate. That is a news conference. And you are listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week. It's dated October 19th, 2012, this particular edition. Thanks so much for joining me today. And now we will turn to the best columns in the U.S., according to the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled Scalia's Smug Certainty by Mary Elizabeth Williams in Salon.com. If you thought constitutional jurisprudence was hard, said Mary Elizabeth Williams, then let Antonin Scalia enlighten you. The Supreme Court Justice told a conservative audience in Washington, D.C. last week that his job is a no-brainer. The death penalty? Give me a break. It's easy, he said. Abortion? Absolutely easy. Homosexual sodomy? Come on. For 200 years, it was criminal in every state. Scalia, of course, is a self-described textualist who insists that the Constitution's meaning can be discerned by a literal reading of what its 18th century authors wrote and intended. Still, it takes a special kind of man to nonchalantly dismiss questions about the death penalty, abortion, restrictions, or what gay people do in the privacy of their homes without considering for a second how they might affect real human lives. Privacy? You have no such right. Pregnant? Tough. Gay? Americans have every right to discriminate against you if they believe your lifestyle is, in his words, immoral and destructive. Alas, poor Antonin, the world is evolving, but not you, content to be living fully in the 18th century. The next column is The Absurdity of Racial Classifications, and that's by Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. Is Elizabeth Warren really a Cherokee? That should be an utterly irrelevant question, said Jeff Jacoby, but it's been a major distraction in the hotly contested U.S. Senate race in Massachusetts. The Democratic challenger, who once listed herself as a Native American because she's supposedly 132nd Cherokee, has been mocked by incumbent Senator Scott Brown as a blonde-haired, blue-eyed faux-Cahanas. In response, Warren has accused Brown of attacking my family. It's a nonsensical argument, except for one fact. Employers are still legally using racial preferences to achieve the goal of diversity. That's undoubtedly why Warren once listed herself in a directory of minority law teachers. Since a great-great-great-grandparent was a Native American, she might get special consideration when applying for jobs. So is Warren white, or is she not? Who cares? Classifying people in neat racial categories is both impossible and foolish. In 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. dreamed of the day when people would be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. It's time to embrace that dream. And the next column is entitled, A Lesson in How to Die, by Bill Keller in the New York Times. If he were in a hospital in the U.S., doctors might have inflicted months of aggressive treatment on Anthony Gilby, said Bill Keller. But when Gilby, my father-in-law, was told he was dying of an inoperable tumor last month in a hospital in Britain, there was no heroic attempt to keep him alive, no brutal regimen of chemotherapy, no dialysis for his failing kidneys. Under a protocol for the dying patient, adopted in most British hospitals, my father-in-law and his family consented to have his medications discontinued, his feeding tube removed, and the beeping machinery disconnected. In the U.S., an end-of-life specialist told me the chances of a humane standard like this being widely adopted is zero. Demagogues like Sarah Palin would shout death panel and insist it was a backdoor form of euthanasia, a heartless way of cutting medical costs. Humane guidelines for end-of-life care probably would save some money, but more importantly, they would provide people with a kinder way of death. In my father-in-law's final 6 days, he joked and laughed, said goodbye, then peacefully slipped away, surrounded by his family. We should all die so well. Now we will turn to the back of the magazine here for the last word, that special article that we read every week. It's always kind of interesting and entertaining, I think. And this week the title is My Digital Nightmare. A hacker stole my family photos and upended my life, says Matt Honan, and it could easily happen to you. In the space of 1 hour, my entire digital life was destroyed. My Google account was taken over, then deleted. My Twitter account was compromised and used to broadcast racist and homophobic messages. And worst of all, my Apple ID account was broken into, and hackers erased all of the data on my iPhone, iPad, and MacBook, including irreplaceable pictures of my family. In many ways, this was my fault. My accounts were connected. Once the hackers got my Amazon password, they were able to get into my Apple ID account, which helped them get into Gmail, which gave them access to Twitter. Had I used two-step verification on my Google account, which sends a second password for your account to your cell phone, it's possible that none of this would have happened, because the hacker's ultimate goal, I later found out, was simply to take over my Twitter account and wreak havoc. Had I regularly backed up the data on my MacBook, I wouldn't have had to worry about losing more than a year's worth of photos, my daughter's whole life, or documents and emails that I had stored in no other location. Those security lapses are my fault, and I deeply regret them. I am a senior writer with Wired.com, but what happened to me can happen to anyone. The hackers who came after me exposed security flaws in several customer service systems, most notably Apple's and Amazon's. Amazon gave the hackers the ability to see a single piece of information, a partial credit card number, that Apple then used to release more information. In short, the very four digits that Amazon considered unimportant enough to display on the web were precisely the ones that Apple considered secure enough to verify my ID. This disconnect points to a looming nightmare for all of us as we enter the era of cloud computing and connected devices. If your computers aren't already cloud-connected devices, they will be soon. Apple is working hard to get all of its customers to use iCloud. Google's entire operating system is cloud-based, and Windows 8, Microsoft's most cloud-centric operating system yet, will hit desktops by the tens of millions in the coming year. I realized something was wrong at about 5 p.m. on a Friday when my iPhone suddenly powered down and rebooted itself to the setup screen. This was irritating, but I assumed it was just a glitch. I entered my iCloud login to restore, and it wasn't accepted. Again, I was irritated, but not alarmed. Then I went to connect the iPhone to my computer and restore from that. When I opened my laptop, a message popped up telling me that my Gmail account information was wrong. Then the screen went gray and asked for a 4-digit PIN. I didn't have a 4-digit PIN. By then, I knew something was very wrong. It occurred to me that I was being hacked. I unplugged my router and cable modem, turned off the Mac Mini we use as an entertainment center, and grabbed my wife's phone to call Apple's tech support. It turns out that a hacker posing as me had given Apple my billing address and the last 4 digits of my credit card number, two easily acquired pieces of information that, along with the email address you use as your Apple ID, were all anyone needed to get into your iCloud account and ruin your digital life. That night, I tried to make sense of what was happening. My Google account was nuked. My Twitter account was suspended. My phone was useless. And for obvious reasons, I was paranoid about using my Apple email account. I set up a new Twitter account until my old one could be restored, just to let people know what was happening. Once that was done, one of my hackers, who later identified himself as Phobia, messaged me and we started a dialogue. Phobia was able to reveal enough details about the hack and my compromised accounts that it became clear he was a party to how it went down. I agreed not to press charges, and in return he said he would lay out exactly how the hack worked. But first I asked him why. He said the hack was simply a grab for my Twitter handle. That's all they wanted. They just wanted to take it and shut up and watch it burn. It wasn't personal. I honestly didn't have any heat toward you before this, he wrote. I just liked your username, like I said before. After coming across my account, the hackers did some easy background research. My Twitter account linked to my personal website, where they found my Gmail address. Guessing that was also the email address I used for Twitter, Phobia went to Google's account recovery page, which is where you turn if you forget your password. Because I didn't have Google's two-step verification turned on, when Phobia entered my Gmail address, he could see my alternate email, the one Google would use to contact me in case of a problem with my account. Google partially obscures that information. This way, it has the M and then 5 dots, then the N at me.com. But there were enough characters to guess that it was simply my name. Phobia had hit the jackpot. This was how the hack progressed. If I'd had some other account aside from an Apple email address or used two-step verification for Gmail, everything would have stopped there. But using my AppleRunMe.com email account as a backup told the hacker I had an Apple ID account, which meant I was vulnerable to being hacked. You honestly can get into any email associated with Apple, Phobia claimed. Since he already had the email, all the need was billing address and the last 4 digits of my credit card number to have Apple's tech support issue him the keys to my account. He got the billing address by doing a Who Is search on my personal web domain. If someone doesn't have a domain, a hacker can easily look up his or her address on websites like Spokio.com, WhitePages.com, or PeopleSmart.com. Getting a credit card number is trickier, but it also relies on taking advantage of a company's back-end systems. Phobia says that a partner performed the social engineering part of the hack, which is usually done by phone. First, Phobia's partner called Amazon and told them he was me and wanted to add a credit card number to my account. He provided my name, email address, and billing address. Amazon allowed him to input a new credit card. Then he hung up. Next, he called back and told Amazon that he'd lost access to my account. When he provided my name, billing address, and the credit card number he had just given the company on the prior call, Amazon allowed him to add a new email address to my account. From there, he went to Amazon website and sent a password reset to the new email address. Now he could see all the credit cards on my account, not the complete numbers, just the last four digits. But as I now know, Apple only asks for those last four digits. It's worth noting that one wouldn't have to call Amazon to pull this off. Your pizza guy, who knows your address and credit card number, could do the same thing, for example. If you have an Apple ID, every time you call Pizza Hut, you're giving the 16-year-old on the other line all he needs to take over your digital life. With my name, address, and the last four digits of my credit card number in hand, phobia called AppleCare, and my digital life was laid waste. Yet I was actually quite fortunate. They could have used my email accounts to gain access to my online banking or financial services. They could have victimized the people in my address book. Instead, the hackers just wanted to embarrass me, have some fun at my expense, and enrage my followers on Twitter by trolling. I had done some pretty stupid things, things you shouldn't do. I should have regularly backed up my MacBook. Because I didn't, if all the photos from the first year and a half of my daughter's life are ultimately lost, I will only have myself to blame. I shouldn't have daisy-chained two vital accounts, my Google and iCloud accounts, together. I shouldn't have used the same email prefix across multiple accounts, mhonan@gmail.com, mhonan@me.com, and mhonan@wired.com. And I should have had a password recovery address that was used for recovery and was not connected to any other accounts. But mostly, I shouldn't have used a service called Find My Mac, which allowed Phobia and his partner to erase every file on my computer. Find My iPhone has been a brilliant Apple service. If your iPhone is stolen or lost, Apple lets you see where it is on a map. And so when Apple introduced Find My Mac last year, I added that to my iCloud options, too. I asked Phobia why he did this to me. His answer wasn't satisfying. He says he likes to publicize security exploits so companies will fix them. He says it's the same reason he told me how it was done. He claims his partner in the attack was the one who wiped my MacBook. Phobia expressed remorse for this and said he would have stopped it had he known. "Yeah, I really am a nice guy. I don't know why I do some of these things I do," he told me. "My goal is to get it out there to other people so eventually everyone can overcome hackers." I asked specifically about the photos of my little girl, which are the greatest loss in all of this. Unless I can recover those photos via data recovery services, they are gone forever. I asked him if he was sorry for doing that. Phobia replied, "Even though I wasn't the one that did it, I feel sorry about that. That's a lot of memories. I'm only 19, but if my parents lost the footage of me and pics, I would be beyond sad, and I'm sure they would be too." The weird thing is, I'm not especially angry at Phobia or his partner. I'm mostly mad at myself. I'm mad as hell for not backing up my data. I'm sad and shocked and feel that I am ultimately to blame for that loss. But I'm also upset that this digital ecosystem that I've placed so much of my trust in has let me down so thoroughly. I'm angry that Amazon makes it so easy to allow someone into your account, which has obvious financial consequences. And then there's Apple. I bought into the Apple account system originally to buy songs at 99 cents a pop. And over the years, that ID has evolved into a single point of entry that controls my phones, tablets, computers, and data-driven life. With that tiny bit of personal data, someone can make thousands of dollars of purchases in an instant or do damage at a cost that you can't put a price on. It was a hard lesson. And that was copyrighted 2012 by Condé Nast Publications, originally published in Wired magazine. From the last word, we will now turn to the health and science section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, "The Great Barrier Reef is Dying." The world's largest coral reef ecosystem is spiraling toward collapse. New research shows that Australia's Great Barrier Reef, which spans some 133,000 square miles and is home to tens of thousands of species, has lost more than half of its coral over the past 30 years. The extent of the loss is just mind-blowing, University of North Carolina biologist John Bruno tells NBCNews.com. Worldwide, coral reefs have declined by 20% in recent decades, mostly because of climate change and the acidification of the seas. Bruno says scientists have long assumed that the Great Barrier Reef's isolation, size, and huge biodiversity would help it resist that decay. In recent years, though, warming waters there have killed coral and spawned more powerful cyclones that damage the delicate reefs. Meanwhile, fertilizer runoff from Australia has fueled a population boom among plankton, which eat the larvae of voracious coral-eating starfish. Marine scientists say only a drastic curbing of fertilizer use can slow the starfish advance, allowing the coral, which now covers only 14% of the reef, to begin growing back. Otherwise, coral cover could fall to just 5% in the next decade. The next item from the Health and Science section, an ancient stream on Mars. NASA's Curiosity rover has uncovered proof that water once flowed swiftly across the surface of Mars. In its first major discovery since its spectacular landing in August, Curiosity beamed back close-up photos showing what appears to be a dry stream bed filled with small rounded pebbles, Space.com reports. Analysis of the size and smooth shape of the pebbles suggests that they once tumbled down a fast-moving stream, with a depth somewhere between ankle and hip deep, says the mission's lead scientist, William Dietrich, of the University of California, Berkeley. Researchers have long believed that channels visible on the surface of Mars are evidence that the planet was once covered in water, but Curiosity's photos mark a transition from speculation to direct observation, Dietrich says. The streams apparently flowed for thousands of years before Mars dried up a couple of billion years ago and became the arid land it is today. What intrigues NASA is that a long-flowing stream can be a habitable environment, says mission scientist John Grotzinger. Curiosity will now search for carbon, which would indicate that microorganisms may have once existed on Mars. The next article from the Health and Science section, remnants of childbirth. Carrying a baby boy in her womb can change a woman's brain permanently and may protect her against Alzheimer's disease later in life. Researchers analyzed the brains of 59 women who died between the ages of 32 and 101 and found that two-thirds of them had bits of male DNA, which scientists believe migrated from the male fetuses the women carried. Fetal cells from daughters might be there too, but would be harder to detect. Though the sample was small, the study found that women with the largest amount of male DNA were also the least likely to have developed Alzheimer's, suggesting that the presence of fetal cells in the female brain prevents disease, cardiologist Hina Chaudhry of Mount Sinai School of Medicine tells ScienceNow.org. Previous research has shown that fetal cells migrate through the placenta into the woman's blood and organs, causing a condition called microchimerism. But until now, researchers weren't sure the cells could enter the brain. Scientists believe that microchimerism from male fetuses may help protect against certain diseases, such as breast cancer. But there's also evidence that it may increase the risk of colon cancer and some autoimmune systems. The cuteness factor. Adorable photos of baby animals may seem distracting, but they can actually aid concentration in the workplace, Time.com reports. Japanese researchers had volunteers complete several tasks designed to test their focus, including playing a board game like Operation, in which they had to remove small pieces from a cramped hole with tweezers without brushing the sides of the hole. In the middle of the task, the volunteers took a break to look at pictures of cute baby animals, adult animals, or tasty-looking foods. After the break, researchers found the volunteers who had viewed the baby animals performed markedly better than the other groups, improving their motor performance by 44% and their number-spotting ability by about 16%. The findings suggest that cute things not only make us happier, but also compel us to act more deliberately and perform tasks with greater time and care, the researchers say. That's because we evolved to be attentive and patient in the presence of babies, qualities that also make us better workers. And the health scare of the week from the health and science section, a new SARS-like virus. A dangerous new respiratory virus has emerged in Saudi Arabia, where it has killed one man and left another in critical condition, the World Health Organization warns. Officials are scrambling to learn more about the new virus, especially how it spreads. We don't know if this is going to turn into another SARS or if it will disappear into nothing, Michael Osterholm, a flu expert at the University of Minnesota, tells the Associated Press. A decade ago, a global outbreak of SARS, or several severe acute respiratory syndrome, infected 8,000 people in some 30 countries, spreading quickly and killing one out of every 10 people it infected. The new virus, which caused kidney failure in both men, belongs to the same coronavirus family and may have originated in bats before making the jump to humans. Researchers are especially concerned that the new virus could infect some of the millions of Muslims from around the world who will converge on Saudi Arabia this month for the annual Hajj pilgrimage before returning home, potentially taking the disease with them. In the past, the Hajj has fueled outbreaks of other serious diseases, including polio and meningitis. Now on to the talking point section of the week. Our first article, did Big Bird, should PBS get off the dole with Big Bird? You do not mess with Big Bird, said Mary Elizabeth Williams in Salon.com. Perhaps Mitt Romney now understands that after having threatened the lovable Muppet with extinction during the presidential debate, the first debate. To illustrate what a frugal spender he'd be, Romney said that even though I love Big Bird, he'd end federal funding for PBS, Sesame Street's home since 1970. Almost immediately, the internet exploded with Big Bird love. Thousands of people took to Twitter to defend the oversized avian from the Republican presidential nominee, including one who tweeted, "Yo, Mitt Romney, Sesame Street is off to you today by the letters, is offered to you today by the letters F and U." It's one thing to pull the plug on PBS's frontline documentaries and twee British dramas, but almost every American under 50 has warm memories of Sesame Street. Besides, giving Big Bird the boot won't make a dent in the deficit, said Lori Rackle in the Chicago Sun-Times. The $450 million the government gives to PBS's parent company for all public broadcasting amounts to about 1/100th of 1% of the federal budget. First of all, I loathe Sesame Street, said Mark Stein in NationalReview.com. Its saccharine, politically correct brainwashing of kids has contributed to the infantilization of society. Second, the nonprofit Sesame Workshop not only gets taxpayer subsidies, it's had close to $1 billion worth of merchandise sales. If Sesame Street isn't commercially viable, nothing is. It's difficult to see why the brokest nation in history should be borrowing money from the Chinese Politburo to pay for it. The Sesame Street gang should get off the dole and move to a commercial channel, said Michael Medved in the DailyBeast.com. While teaching toddlers the letters of the alphabet, Sesame Street could also instruct in independence, pride, and self-reliance. The outrage over cutting Big Bird subsidies perfectly captures the fiscal mess this country is in, said Mark Caputo in the Miami Herald. Every government dollar has a constituency, and any proposed cut brings screams of bloody murder. When Democrats suggest reducing defense spending, Republicans accuse them of threatening jobs and national security. When conservatives try to trim entitlements, liberals call them heartless granny killers. But if the U.S. is ever going to stop adding to its $16 trillion national debt, everything, including even friendly fake birds, has to share in the pain. And as we reach the end of our program for this week, let's take a look at a few short items here in the Talking Points section. 67.2 million people watched the first presidential debate on TV, making it the most watched first debate since Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan's only debate in 1980. The TV audience was larger than for any of President Obama's 2008 debates, either of his convention speeches or any of his State of the Union addresses. During the recession years of 2007 to 2010, Americans' median household net worth dropped by 39%, but the median estimated net worth of members of Congress rose 5% during those years, according to an analysis of congressional finances. The wealthiest one-third in Congress saw their net worth go up by 14%. Americans are expected to spend $370 million on Halloween costumes for their pets this year, $70 million more than last year. An estimated 15% of the population will buy outfits for their pets. The U.S. birth rate fell last year for the fourth year in a row, dropping to its lowest level on record. Demographers say hard times are causing women to postpone having children. And the popularity of medical marijuana in Colorado has an unintended side effect. Soaring numbers of severely stoned dogs in veterinarians' offices. Pets can get very sick after eating weed-laced food, and some of them actually do die. And now with the poll watch for this week, in dealing with illegal immigration, 50% of registered voters say the government's priority should be to develop a plan to allow immigrants to become legal residents. 39% say the priority should be to stop illegal immigrants from entering the country and to deport them. And 69% of Americans favor assassinating known terrorists. 41% approve of using torture on suspected terrorists. And those are our poll watches for this week. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long, until next time.